GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It is Saturday, January 22nd, 2011. Today on GeekSpeak, Geek News, we've got a full complement, and we'll be taking your calls and comments. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Oh, you're kidding me. I got it set up. Join the Car Guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the second half of the show, we'll be inviting you to join us via phone with questions and comments about technology. I'm Miles Elam. In the air room with me are Al Luckow, new media architect.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, I should be bringing folks up.
Hello, everybody.
That's right. I'm running the board today. Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy, Stanford instructor.
How's it going?
Alex Slius, application security analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
And Lindsay Lani, system analyst.
Good morning.
Nope.
Uh-oh. Are you on five? Let's try that again.
Good morning, everybody.
There she is.
That sounds better. So let's start off with some geek news. Ben, you want to lead us off?
I certainly can. I have some astrology news, actually. Not astronomy, astrology. You know, like my sign is in, I'm a Virgo, and so I have this horoscope or whatever.
I have a sinking feeling that you did not listen to last week's show.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't. Actually, I just found this article. I replaced my first one, and I thought, oh man, I should really ask Al next to me if you cover this. But
well, I have an announcement.
Yes.
Yeah. On the podcast last week, we came up with the idea that we have this momentous hard drive, and we were going to give it away, you know, at the Christmas thing, and we wanted to find somebody that had the exact birthday and the year and all. Well, it turns out nobody really fit exactly, and you know, we said it had to be exact.
So the birthday paradox does not include birth years, apparently.
Right.
It's
so,
apparently such a boring day that
it was so boring.
Nobody
people weren't
was
even
born on it.
Yeah, even be born.
Or at least none of those boring people live in the Santa Cruz area
or right. Listen to GeekSpeak via podcast.
Then they're absolutely boring.
So we thought, why don't we open it up to just podcast listeners? Because, you know, these people get it after the fact, and they're like, they can never really get anything. So
I was thinking it was also fair, just because the parade ended up being such a bad recording.
Yeah,
folks, you are an unfair advantage, you podcasters.
It was a puzzle, because you had to try to listen. And what it was is you had to tell us what we'd mentioned that during that show, which was what was the most boring day, and what was the exact make and model of the hard drive we were going to give away. And then we posed the question again at the end of last week's podcast. So the only people that heard that would have been people who downloaded the podcast. And we have a winner. His name is Nicholas Baum. And he told us that the most boring day was April 11th, 1954, and that we were giving away the Seagate Momentous SSD hybrid hard drive. So, Nicholas, why don't you give us an email with your address? Unless you're in Santa Cruz and you can get here like right away, we can hand it to you. But otherwise, we'll mail it out to you. And since you're a podcast listener, you probably won't hear this for another couple of days.
Yeah,
but when you do...
I think he said he listens on Mondays, every Monday.
Is that what he said? Yep. Okay. Well, Monday. Now everybody knows it was Nicholas Baum. He's the winner.
And it should be noted that a lot of people wrote in. A lot of people wrote in with this thing. And because I didn't listen to that podcast, I was wondering, like, why are all these people answering this this question? I'm getting all these emails in my inbox on the Geek Folder.
Well, people got it right. We it had to be the first person to get it right. That we had to have something, you know, and he was the first person. So a lot of people got it right.
Okay.
So I do have a story, which we didn't cover last week.
I don't know, man. Like,
did I spoil it? If you want to hear the story I was planning to cover, listen to last week's show and listen to another geek cover my story.
I believe that geek would have been me.
Yeah, stole my story. Anyway, that's fun. But I just have a quick mention then, which I got from the Bad Astronomy blog, which is, and the headline of this is Squishy Moonrise Seen from Space. So it's actually a series of photographs that were taken on the International Space Station by one of the astronauts, Paolo Nespoli. And it's really, really cool. You're actually like watching this moon. It's a series of pictures, not a video, but you over the series, you see this moon, our moon, rising up through the horizon or through the atmosphere of the Earth. And it's really beautiful because it's not just like it's rising over the Earth. It's actually, it's really squished at first because it gets distorted through the atmosphere and everything. And so in this blog post, Phil Plate goes over why that happens and what makes that happen, what makes the moon look squished. And of course, this isn't something that many of us see very often, seeing the moon rise from space. So also very cool to see that too.
Yeah, that's also surprising to hear him talking about it being squished, because he usually refers to squishy science as being things like biology and and the like.
Squishy science and hard science.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic blog. And of course, you can get to his blog from the post up on geekspeak.org.
Thank you very much, Ben. And Alex.
All right. Well, you know how when you drive down the street, we see the cameras all over the place, and you see on buildings, there's all the cameras everywhere, and pretty much there's video cameras everywhere. Well, a lot of these cameras are switching from being the more analog type, where it's your old style camera sending the analog signal to some recorder in some back
room. The old closed circuit TV. Yeah.
Exactly. So these new ones, though, are a bit more modern, and they're IP based. And so basically these end up connecting to some sort of network connection and are accessible. They handle all the video processing and basically render the video within the camera and just make it available on a stream.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. So there's a lot of question about this, because people are, just not thinking about the security, think, well, let's just hook it up to our internet connection and we can just access it from anywhere. Well, so can anybody else. And apparently even Google, you can do some Google searches for model numbers and find the interfaces for a lot of these, and a lot of them are not configured properly. So you have, anybody can go
in and
access.
At least not anymore.
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of those are just not secured properly, and it's just something to be aware of when you see all these cameras out there. The people who implement these things do not necessarily understand the security implications.
It's kind of like the beginnings of the commercial internet. People were going, hey, let's get this done. We've got this technology available. We can do it. Oh, well, security. No one would ever want to do that.
The beginnings? It's still like that.
It's getting better. You have to admit, it's getting a lot better.
It's better.
Used to be I'm going to put in my search query. Oh, let me put in, dash dash. All right, semicolon dash dash.
So basically we're dealing with a lot of cameras out there on the internet that are insecured and IP based, and I'm sure now that I've said this on the radio and on the podcast, you get a whole bunch of more people aware of this and doing this.
Just IP based, or are they wireless as well?
I don't know if they're wireless. The article I came across was really focused on the IP based. If they are wireless, that's obviously a whole set, but that's actually less a risk than the IP based, because the IP opens up to the internet, as opposed to still being a local issue, which was the original camera issues.
Right. So, but still, I wonder if they're, because some of them might be wireless, so they don't have to route that cable up and down the pipe. Although you would have to power it, so I guess it doesn't make
much sense. Well, you know what's funny is I did the UI for Logitech's alert system, which is all security cameras, and it uses home plug. So it's not wireless.
So data communication over a home power network.
Yeah, so the plug.
Or power.
That you plug in, because you got to plug the camera in, it needs power. So you plug it in, but the whole video stream and everything goes through the electrical wires of your house and then is interpreted at your router. So, or, you know, they'll have a receiver. So it doesn't use wireless and it doesn't use Ethernet. So it's not really using bandwidth of any sort within your own house. It's a whole other way of transmitting.
It's not using wireless bandwidth.
No. No, I mean, it's bandwidth in your electrical outlets.
Yeah, it's Ethernet over power.
Yeah, yeah.
Ethernet over power as opposed to power over Ethernet. Oh, the many different wrinkles. Anyway, moving on. Lindsay.
All right, I'm going to switch gears here.
So to speak.
Right. Wah, wah. So we've broken the land speed record for solar car. As of January 7th, the new world record in the Guinness is going to go into the Guinness Book at 54.68 miles per hour, 88 kilometers per hour for those of us outside of the United States, over the space of 1 kilometer, using about the same power as a toaster, so 1,050 watts. The vehicle is called the SunSwift Ivy, and it was built from scratch in 2009 by students from the University of New South Wales in Sydney. They managed to convert about 98% of power from solar panels to kinetic energy. The project took about 18 months and cost about $280,000 plus stuff provided from sponsors.
Very cool.
Looking at this vehicle, it looks kind of just like a big square wafer with solar panels on top, and it's got 3 wheels underneath. Of course, they removed the battery to do the race, but it's pretty neat looking. The previous record was 78 kilometers per hour by General Motors Sun Racer in 1987, so it's been a while since the record was broken.
So the previous was 78, and the new one is what?
88.
Wow. 88 miles or kilometers per hour.
13% faster using 25% less power.
Wow.
Yeah.
All they need is a flux capacitor.
Exactly. Yeah. We're ready to go.
On a sunny day.
So, Ben?
Yes.
Do you have another story?
Yes. Actually, I did not fail on the horoscope news because there are actually two horoscope news items, and you guys covered the other one, which I wasn't going to cover. So, with that out of the way, you didn't cover the word cloud one, did you?
I guess not. No, a word cloud astrology.
Yeah, so imagine this, right? First of all, I'm just going to go on the record saying that astrology is complete nonsense. Getting that out of the way, if you look up your horoscope and you're like, oh, that really fits me, right? That totally, like, they're using words and sentences to describe me. And then, you know, this other person looks at their horoscope and they think the same thing and everything. There have been a number of studies where they've switched up the horoscopes and said, all right, look at your horoscope. Is that you? And people say, oh, yeah, it is. But it's actually, you know, they've swapped the horoscopes.
You realize now that we've now alienated a good proportion of Santa Cruz County.
I apologize. I apologize.
It's fun. It's a fun, entertaining thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it is without any use. I would say that it's not backed up by any science at all. And of course, that's just my opinion.
However,
fortune
cookies, on the other hand.
Yeah.
Fortune cookies are real.
Once, right before I taught, I got a fortune cookie that said, you will soon be the center of attention. I thought, that's so right.
Anybody ever see that Amazing Stories where the fortune cookie says, you're going to die?
No, but so the story that I was going to cover is there's a fantastic, fantastic website that everyone should know about called Information is Beautiful. And they do a really good job taking basically any interesting data that is out there and finding some way to visualize it or to communicate it in a really nice way. What they did is they made a word cloud of horoscopes. And so they took all of these different horoscopes for all the different signs, and they looked at the words that recurred most often, and they made what's called a word cloud, where the words that recur the most are largest in this cloud of words, right? And the ones that recur less often are smaller. And sure enough, every single one of the horoscopes looks pretty much identical. All of them use the word sure, all of them use the word feel, all of them use the word keep a ton. And there's no easily discernible difference between any of these. So just a very interesting, an interesting little chart. And also, of course, being on the website called Information is Beautiful, they really did do a good job of making it look pretty and making it easily understandable without even reading anything aside from looking at the graphics. So I'll put that up on geekspeak.org.
Very cool. Al.
Yes.
What you got up next?
Well, I think I have a little tech potty humor.
No, not potty humor.
What?
It's, you know how, you know, devices come out in the U.S. and then, like, China makes one, like, just like it, and they just name it something. Mm-hmm. And they're not really thinking real hard about the name. And they just...
Yeah, instead of like, a MacBook, it becomes, like, MacBook.
Yeah, something a little odd.
Like a letter. Or...
Well, they're from a site, I found, there's a new pad that just came out. It's an Android tablet from China, and it's called the iPoo.
No way. It's,
yes, indeedly doodly.
It's, yes, this is very much like, and the U.S. companies do this too. This is like Ford trying to market the Nova in Latin American countries. Never mind the fact that Nova means it doesn't go.
Right. Well, this is from a site called GizChina, and it's all everything about Chinese gadgets and techs and clones and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I mean, you thought it was kind of funny when the Nintendo Wii came out, you know.
And when the iPad came out.
The iPad, you know, but now they have the iPoo, and it's, you know, it's an Android tablet. It's not, the specs aren't really that great. 256 megs of RAM, 600 megahertz chip inside of it. It's not really great. It does have a screen.
So the name is applicable.
It's
a real piece of poo.
they threw subtlety out the window.
Well, when this product hits the fans, I mean, hits the stores, you know, a lot of people are going to be, what the heck? You know, I have an iPoo, you know, it's so weird, you know, it's like...
Are there any other instances of this type of technology naming?
Oh, there's, I mean, all different kinds of them. There's another product out that is another tech, sort of more of a tech potty humor. It's the Sony toilet, and they spell it T-O-Y... Like toy.
Like it's a little toy.
Yeah, like toy and then L-E-T. So it's a Sony toilet. But it's kind of appropriate.
But it's actually Sony.
It's
not a knockoff.
No. Well, no.
It's a name brand.
It's not available here. And what they do with this thing is it's sort of a game that goes above a urinal. And it detects the rate of flow and has a little video screen. And you're able to accomplish different tasks. Well, at the urinals.
Wait, so this is doing...
What?
Yes.
Wait, is this supposed to encourage potty training for kids, or is this supposed to make, you know, men with enlarged prostates feel really bad about their performance?
Well, I don't know whether their performance isn't as good or what, but this isn't even that weird to in the Asian countries. I mean, there's already... Sega already has one of these too. I mean, this is like not that strange to them.
Wait, there's competition in this field.
Well, actually, if you carry a USB, a little USB drive, a flash drive, you can put it in these things and save your scores. So then when you go to a urinal again, you can plug it back in and keep your scores. It's a USB flash drive. So now you can keep your top score with you. I don't think there's anything for women.
That's sexist. Yeah, but, where's my game?
Yeah, but it's in like metro stations and different places like that. And there's all different kinds of little games that you end up playing by doing this. So, little tech potty humor for you.
Right then.
Yep. Okay. Anyway,
so let's have a story that's completely different, Alex.
All right, let's go to a different kind of toy. A bit more of your geek gadget kind of toy. We have the world's first HDR video system.
What does HDR stand for?
High dynamic range. What that means is basically the human eye has the ability to adjust for extreme bright and darkness of in contrast. So we can see the really the detail in really bright areas, and we can see the detail in really dark areas. Well, cameras can't do that as well. Typically... you know, you get that blown out highlight where you're focused on a darker scene, but the sky is just completely white because it's just completely blown out. Well, HDR is able to bring in that full range.
Right, some of the new iPhones range. Do that, and I think some other cell right. phone cameras and some exactly. digital cameras do that.
Digital cameras do that. A lot of them do that. It's a the way a lot of cameras do it is they do it where they take multiple pictures and then they merge them together.
So what's special about this new video system?
Well, this is video that does this. This is the world's first time that video has
done it. Oh, right.
Everything has been still pictures that has done that so far. Of course, it results in rather large files. Each frame is 24 megabytes. That means that every second is 42 gigabytes. Wow. Or wait, is that minutes? So let me double check that math.
That would be minutes.
Minutes. Okay. Well, 24 frames per second. So...
That's
amazing. Fast.
But the quality of the video, I mean, basically that you're having perfect exposure
all the time.
Every second.
That's curious as to why it would be so large.
Well, raw files are large.
Yeah. You know? It's basically one raw file per frame. And you take a digital camera and shooting it, say, 15, 18 megapixels in a raw format, it's about 24 megabytes.
Well, it's. For example, because I own one, I know the stats on it a little bit better, but the iPhone 4 does it a little bit differently. They take three photos,
mm-hmm.
one of them being a white balance being set very high, then set very low, and then a medium, and then kind of merges the
Well, the difference is the resulting image you get from your iPhone is not an HDR image. It's a recomposited into a final result. It doesn't contain the high dynamic range.
Okay.
It processes it and makes a new JPEG. It takes in the highlights, it pulls up the shadows, and produces a final image
that makes sense.
Pulled together. Uh-huh. And then it says, here's your JPEG. Whereas, if it were actually retaining the full range, it would actually have all those multiple pictures in one file, effectively.
Okay. As long as you're okay with, 40 gigabytes?
42 gigabytes per, I believe, minute. I was trying to scroll real quick to see per minute. 42 gigs per minute.
How does this thing store all of this video?
Yeah, that was my thought too.
Because if you transfer from a really fast hard drive, you're not going to get 42 gigs in less than 15 minutes.
The article didn't quite get into full detail of the specs. My guess is they're dealing with SSD.
Maybe
they're
it just lets you record for 30 frames
multiple
or something.
Systems.
But yeah, but a 250 gig SSD, that means you get 6 minutes before continuous.
How much would like say an hour be with that? You figure 60 times that, you're still under a terabyte. Oh no, you're just over two terabytes.
No, it's
all right. So you get a couple of
we're having the conversation.
2 terabyte drives.
We're having the conversation now, but I mean, if we turn back the clock 10 years, and I remember when I used to go into work, I'd have to bring this big drive, and I called it the gig, and it was a big drive, and it was heavy, and it had a SCSI connector, and now you can get a gig on the thing that's smaller than your fingernail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
in fact, they're the small ones. We're like, oh, that's too small. I can't find it anymore.
Yeah, it blew away, And it's like that kind of dramatic difference. I mean, we're freaking out about the size right now, but hey, this is going to, give it a couple of years.
Yeah, and this reminds me of an article that Ben had brought up or a comment Ben had brought up quite a while, months ago, where he questioned the size of drives. And I was saying, you know what? We always find a way to fill the space. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, size doesn't matter. So, GeekSpeak on KUSB is supported by Palo Alto Medical Foundation, Santa Cruz, and Sutter Maternity and Surgery Center, community-based, not-for-profit. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSB. And, sorry, I'm looking over my different items here. We're going to take some calls. The numbers are 1-800-655-5877 or locally 476-2800. Or you can contact us. Go to geekspeak.org and send us a comment. And we're also on IRC. What's the channel, Alex?
I believe you have to go to Freenode. Was it .net or .com? One of those.
Do we have instructions up on our website?
I think it's actually Lyle has it on his website, lyle.troxel.com.
Yeah. Okay. So that works out. And once again, that phone number is 476-2800 or toll free at 800-655-5877. All right. Who's next for news? I believe we're on Lindsay.
Okay. Well, I have sort of my own public service announcement for all the grandmas out there. If you're using AOL for email and you have a different ISP, you don't need to pay the subscription for AOL anymore. It's about $20 a month. And so 80% of AOL's revenue is from subscribers, and about 75% of those are only using it for email, which the email is free. They don't need it as the ISP. So there's a nice website out there that gives you step-by-step, because a lot of their website stuff makes it difficult to unsubscribe, and calling on the phone, they also make it kind of difficult to unsubscribe. And, you know, if you're lazy like me, or, you know, your grandma doesn't want to deal with a website, they can go here and it gives really clear screenshot step-by-step instructions on how to unsubscribe to that subscription service so you can save yourself $20 a month if you're not using it for an ISP. And that's my story.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
I have wondered why people did that. I mean, you know, people like connect through their DSL connection, and then they just kind of decide they like their AOL, so they keep thinking they have to click on that little program that logs them into AOL through their DSL connection.
You have mail.
I mean, it's like basically a VPN service, yeah. Effectively.
Yeah.
But you don't need it to access the internet because you're already
just
on the internet.
That's though, like 80%. Is of the revenue is that, and then 75% of that 80%, so 60% of AOL's revenue is them taking money from people who don't realize that they don't have to give them money.
So if I disappear, you know what happened.
Yeah. Right.
We knew AOL was evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've known that for a long time. Right?
Thank you for that story. Mm-hmm. Let's take some calls. Tom in Santa Cruz.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Tom. I have a question. First of all, I'll preface with that I'm pretty much broke all the time, and I'm not very good at computers, but in electronics, so-so. But what I wanted to do was set up an electronics workbench to build a stereo system. And so I was looking on the internet, and I found some schematics on to build a signal generator and, you know, a multimeter and stuff like this, and some of this stuff would, you know, started to add up, even if I built it myself. Well, I found a program for the computer that you can download and make your computer into an oscilloscope. Well, and a signal generator and so forth and so on. Well, I only have two USB ports, and I thought, well, if I made a thing for, you know, maybe for more USB ports, you know, that would work. But then I thought, well, I need one port for input for, let's say, probes, and another USB port output for a signal generator and so on and so on, the same for multimeters and that. And I don't know if I made multiple USB ports and I had the program for the oscilloscope, would the one port interfere, let's say a signal generator interfere with an inductance meter on the other port and so forth and so on? How would I go about building so I could interface, let's say, meters to the computer. Do you get the idea?
I don't think that USB, you can have two ports. They're independent of each other. And but when you get a hub, the one thing you want to be sure of is you get a powered hub. It sounds like you're going to put all sorts of stuff on there. And what happens a lot of times, people buy hubs and they're not powered. And they're like, how come this doesn't work? You're going to need a powered hub.
Yeah, so if you see a deal for like at Fry's Electronics, $2 for a USB hub, that's probably not going to be a powered hub.
Yeah. Right, but you can get them for pretty cheap. And
you can.
Somewhere in the range of like $10 to $20.
Yeah. Yeah. Seen, so. Yeah, but just make sure you have to plug it in because that's going to be a problem.
And the other question was, I know on a oscilloscope itself, you're able to, let's say, by mistake, you use the probes to plug it into the wall socket. And that, but you have it set up for, let's say, a 5-volt power supply you're working on, and it won't blow your meter. But would that blow your computer if you did that by mistake? If you use your computer as the oscilloscope?
Well, anytime you put too much power down a line, you can cause problems with the components. USB has very specific specs for power.
Yeah, but you understand when you have, a oscilloscope, And you have your probes and you're checking points and say, let's say, inside a stereo system, and so he touches a certain point and he has a, you know, greater voltage than another one. You're not going to blow your.
I would think there'd be a fuse in there. I mean, it's going to depend on your device. I mean, you put something up there, you're going to have a fuse in that device. Nothing's going to just let raw power shoot through there. Especially if it's a computer component, you're going to have, you know, like an optocoupler or something in there. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. So. So I'm just worried about, you know, if I'm testing one thing I had hooked up for, let's say, an inductor. I'm trying to get a certain so many Henrys out of it. And that, and is there going to be interference between the two ports as far as...
Yeah, unfortunately, our electronics geek, Lyle, isn't here. So any advice we give is probably going to be... useless at best, dangerous at worst. So.
Okay. You know who we know is the guys over on Life Hacker and Girls.
That is true.
Post on a forum there.
That are some of the local shops. Like some of the folks at Santa Cruz Electronics may be able to give you more information on that as well.
But the main thing is to get a powered hub.
Powered hub, yeah. Or else you're going to run into all sorts of problems and not know why, because you're going to have your USB plugged in and it's like not working.
That's what I need to know.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for the call, Tom.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
And on line two, we have Ian from Aptos. Hello, Ian.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
So my question is this. I got an iPad for Christmas, and I work in a company that uses Windows, and I'd really like to be able to take my iPad as my only computer when I travel and then use it to be able to access Outlook, to be able to carry maybe a thumb drive with some presentations that I could use, you know, and use the iPad as my computer on the road. A, is that possible? And B, have you got any pointers to help me go about doing that?
Get a Mobile Me account. You get a Mobile Me account on your PC, and essentially it's going to sync with your files on your PC. So Mobile Me, basically, I think it's like $99 a year or something like that. It's not... And what it does is it syncs your calendar, and there's a documents area. I use it sometimes for GeekSpeak. I'll actually just make a text file, dump it on Mobile Me, and I'll open it either on my laptop or on my iPad or whatever, because Mobile Me is sort of it's like cloud storage. So your files will be able to work that way. And as long as
you have connectivity.
You need to have internet connectivity.
As long as you're either at a Wi-Fi hotspot or if you have the 3G version of the iPad and it have access.
So you'll need the internet service. Stuff. Yeah. Definitely. And then iTunes, depending on the apps that you purchase, various apps allow you to store files. So you have iTunes on your PC, and you have an application like, say, GoodReader, all right, which, you know, you purchase that and you have it. These are like $1, $2 things, you know, these applications. And GoodReader will read just about any kind of text file, and you just sort of store them somewhere on your PC, and then you drag them into iTunes under the app section, and it will sync to your device, whether you have an iPhone or an iPad or whatever. So that remains resident on your iPad. So that would be, you know, all different. And I've tried things like Excel spreadsheets, and they open up in GoodReader, PDFs, text files, all different kinds of stuff like that. So there's lots of ways to sync with the iPad with a PC, just tons of ways. And if you have like Gmail or something like that, that is obviously doesn't matter what you're using. You could use your iPad. You could use, you know, your PC.
Yeah.
Your
and as
Mac
far as yeah, as far as using your iPad for a system, I mean, Al, I was about to say it's unusual that you actually have a full laptop. You just have your iPad.
I usually just
use it up the show.
Yeah, because it's much easier to deal with. Except, I was worried today that it was just going to be you and me. So I was like, all right, I'm going to bring everything I have in case we run out of stuff to talk about. But everybody showed up, so I was like, whew, you know. But yeah, there's lots of ways to do it. Totally, you know, you'll have fun with it too.
So let me ask you this. Thank you. Firstly, this is brilliant. You've allayed a lot of anxiety. But question about presentation. Is there a way to hook up an iPad, say, to a projector if I walk into somebody else's office and I need to project onto a larger, you know, monitor or something like that?
You know, there is. And there's little... connectors you need to buy. I haven't done it myself. There's a number of ways to move from iPad to things. Like, for example, there's AirPlay, which allows you to take your iPad wirelessly and just directly go to an Apple TV thing, for example. So if you have an HDTV and you've got an Apple TV up there, Apple TV is just another inexpensive sort of hub-like thing. You can just shoot video directly from your iPad to the TV, or you can play within a network. Now, the trick with an iPad isn't so much projecting. You can hook it up to a projector just like you could an iPhone. You could hook – there's these projectors called Pico projectors, and you just plug your device into it. I've used
– As long as you're in very low light because they're not very powerful.
They're laser lights now, and I've used this one time, and I plugged it into an iPhone, and it did work pretty well. And because it's a laser projection, there's no focus. Like a lot of times,
okay.
You know, you always have a lens and you have to focus it. Well, laser, you don't have to focus. So you could use an iPad with a Pico projector or you could hook an iPad up to a traditional projector. The trick is, what are you going to be playing on the iPad? So I know that
certain apps can do that,
right.
That output. Yeah.
I've used Keynote on the iPad, which I don't know that it's available for the PC. I doubt it, but there are probably a number of other slideshow things. I mean, I could look it up and maybe post it on the forums. But you were able to you could actually take a PDF in GoodReader and then go page by page, and you could give basically a slideshow using that if each page were the same, were sized to be the size of the iPad screen. So you could definitely project that.
I guess one of two possibilities. You get the little connector that's the AV cable.
Yeah, the AV out.
That's like... $50 or something like that.
You'd be looking at it's something like that. They're little doohickeys that, you know, are more expensive than they need to be, but they're not.
Or the Apple TV, which if you're streaming video or want to stream something like that. But that's going to be more limited in what you can sync off.
Right, because it'll be something you have at home. But, I mean, you get, you know, an iPad, you just have so much fun messing with the thing. I mean, I have one of them, and it's just, there's so many things you can do with that. It doesn't matter if you're using a PC or a Mac or whatever you're using.
Well, does that answer your question, Ian?
Oh, more than. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Cheers.
And a quick note for anyone who's looking for the functionality of MobileMe but isn't using like an iPhone or an iPad or something like that, MobileMe is like somewhere around $100. You can actually get all of the functionality
For a year.
You can get all of the functionality for free with other various applications. Obviously, Google has a lot of the functionality, and then Dropbox is a really great alternative to file storage. So if anyone's looking for that for free, check that out.
Dropbox has an app.
Dropbox doesn't have an app. Yeah,
you can download the app for your phone, which is, I think, free.
And we talked about it before on the show before, but at the same time, what's Dropbox?
It's online cloud storage.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't do
so
the
what's
sync.
Dropbox?
So you put some files into a folder on your computer, and without you doing anything, it syncs it up to some servers somewhere, right? So your data's relatively safe on their servers, and if you want to connect other computers, then you can connect that up as well. And then the data will not only go up to the cloud to the servers, but it'll also come back down to all of your computers. So it's a good way of collaborating with documents and also sharing documents with yourself between your computers.
Okay, so the nutshell is you put a file on your phone, it shows up on your computer. You put a file on your computer, it shows up on your phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's accessible from your phone.
Accessible, yeah.
Right.
It's relatively safe.
Says the security analyst.
Well, I didn't want to say it was safe because I knew one of you guys would be like, don't back up with Dropbox or anything, you know, like actually have legitimate backups, but it's pretty good.
Okay.
And the way they get you is if you want a lot more space, they charge you for that. They give you like a gig or something.
They give you 2 gigs, and then if you refer other people, you get, I think, like 250 megs more.
And ergo is Ben's motivation right now.
If you join.
Ben sent you.
Yeah, don't join through the homepage. Join through my custom link.
All right.
10 terabytes by the end.
Thank you for that. And moving on to line 3, Doug in Santa Cruz.
Hello. Yes. I'm having this thing comes up on my computer.
Sorry, are you on a speakerphone right now?
Yes.
If you could pick up the receiver, perhaps.
Pick up the receiver?
Pick up the handset.
He's sounding a little better. I think he was just...
Oh, okay.
You know.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, let me see if I... Can you hold on just a second?
Sure.
We'll wait here.
We could sing a theme song.
I'm just looking at the thing Ben brought up, that beautiful visualization website. Dang, that's very cool.
I brought that up?
Yeah, you brought it up. You were
talking.
Yeah. And you talked about
the original thing that you're going to put the link up to.
You talked about the horoscope thing, but I mean, that website is very neat. And then I'm like going to various links from it. And
hello?
Yes.
Hello, yes.
Okay, Okay. It says in the new Yahoo Mail Classic, changing your browser's encoding may corrupt the message while sending.
What is it you're trying to do with the browser?
It's recommended that your browser's encoding, usually under the browser's view menu, is set to UTF-8. This is a message that comes up every time I click on my Yahoo Mail on Windows. And it's blue and red, so I guess it's from Windows.
Does it happen whenever you try to go to Yahoo Mail or whenever
go to my inbox, this thing comes up.
What web browser? Do you know what web browser you're using? Or what color the icon is that you double-click on to get onto the internet, to get to Yahoo?
I use, what do you mean, Explorer?
Yeah, Internet Explorer.
Yeah, I have XP.
Do you click on the big blue E?
I have three different ways that I can get it. I can get it, on my...
Yahoo's complaining that they want to view the inbox in, a certain UTF-8 or whatever it is, and you can change your browser to do that in the settings menu if you wanted to. They just probably want to show you some special stuff on their inbox that won't show unless you're using that encoding.
Actually, a quick question for you would be, do you ever communicate with someone in European countries? Do you ever use any characters with accent marks or like the Cydia,
or Korea or China?
No, but sometimes that stuff pops up on my my webpage and I don't know what it is.
Well, pretty safe to say that it would never really affect you, because everything that you type in would still, even if you were using ASCII or what's called ISO 8859-1 or .15, mm-hmm. will work just fine. To get rid of the message, aside from following their instructions, which is go down and choose UTF-8, which won't hurt anything, you could also try a different web browser. You could try downloading Mozilla Firefox or Google Chrome, Opera, and if you want to send us a message, we can give you links to those browsers as well. But yeah. It doesn't sound like it's a catastrophic failure. It sounds like just an annoying message that wouldn't cause any real hardship.
Yeah, so you're not actually at risk or anything like that.
It has an X there, and I just delete it. I delete that, and then my mail comes back up.
Right. It's just a warning message that Yahoo put in there.
Annoying pop-up message.
Right. I'm pretty sure if you downloaded the newest version of Firefox or Google Chrome, that you wouldn't see that error message anymore. Probably improve your web browsing experience in general.
Yeah, so that's definitely one thing to try, is to download Firefox or to download Chrome. And you can either do a Google search, or if you send us
message. I like my Explorer XP. I've gotten used to it, and I tried to go to Mozilla, and I couldn't get used to it.
Well, there are, I guess, two options. One is you could find a way to disable the message in Internet Explorer if you don't want to change. The other is you can just go ahead and live with it and just X out whenever you want and just, deal with the annoyance of having to close it.
How would I get to delete this message that keeps popping up?
That's not necessarily something that we can tell you right now without having maybe more information or more time as well, just because
I need to email you.
You can either email us, or you can also, I'm sure probably some other people may have this have this error. And so if you do a Google search, you may be able to find information on how to disable it as well.
Okay, cool.
All right. Thanks for the call. All right. Take care. Okay. And we definitely have time for another call. John in Scotts Valley.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I've got a problem with a C drive that's packed, it's barely, it keeps throwing up messages that it's overfull. And I added another hard drive to this PC. It's a considerably more capacity, but for some reason, I'm unsure about how to divert traffic from programs or whatever's being loaded. In this case, it's music from my kids. They keep packing my C drive.
Oh, and you everything keeps going into that first drive and not going to the bigger drive that you just
added
on.
Right. So I've got all this available capacity on what I've named the E drive, and you know I can't seem to utilize it.
Well, it's showing up as the E drive, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so the computer is seeing it. It's just a matter of getting the programs to want to write to it. A lot of times you have to actually specify when it asks, where do you want to save the file? You have to tell it where to save it.
Right.
If it's for programs you're trying to install, when you do your installation, a lot of times you can change where, you know, you can specify where you want it to install. By default, it'll go to C program files.
Right. Most of the time when you install a program, it'll say, do you want typical installation or do you want custom? And from now on, you're going to have to choose custom.
But if he wants to just dump his, move his iPhone library or iTunes library.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
That's what Rick was saying in the, he typed in the Etherpad there.
Yeah. iTunes probably would work okay. There are some programs where they have registry entries where it would be it would be a harder move.
Well, but he said his kid, that's what his kids, you know, that's what's causing the, I mean, usually you look at your music, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah,
right.
That's what this is. It's iTunes, I think, is the primary effect.
Well,
if
that's that case, from preferences, that's
if that's
easy.
The case, you can also just go into iTunes and say, I want the music to be on E drive.
Yeah, like if you go into the iTunes preferences, then you can set the location of the music library. And that's really easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Really? Okay.
Yeah, just in the preferences, and you'll see it. It's, you know, changed.
You go to edit. It's under edit preferences, and then under the advanced tab, you should be able to specify it. If you go do a quick search for on Google for move iTunes library in Windows, the first link will be Apple's webpage that walks you through how to move your library.
Yeah. I do that same exact thing.
Another thing. And as far as moving things that are, I mean, does this change what's on C over to E, or does it just change anything that's new?
Last time I did a migration, iTunes asked me what I wanted done, like to move the stuff over, or whether or not it was just pointing for new stuff. Then again, I've had issues where some of my stuff was in one drive and some of my stuff was in another with iTunes. So,
iTunes has a feature called Consolidate Files or Consolidate Library, depending on what version you're running. But oftentimes, you can select some songs in your library and right-click on them, and you'll probably have an option to consolidate those files, which means move them from wherever they are scattered throughout your hard drive, copy them from there, and move them onto your new drive where you've set it to keep the library. The other thing is sometimes when you do that, it'll only copy the files instead of moving them. And so it might be a good idea just to go on Google and check out the how-to guide just in case, because I don't think any of us have done it in the last couple months, and iTunes changes versions like at the drop of a hat. So.
Very true.
Okay. All right. I'll check it out. Thanks.
Another thing that's useful is if in your browser you have the default download location set to somewhere on the C drive, to move that default down location in your browser to the E drive, so that if your kids are on and they're just downloading files, it automatically puts it on the E drive.
Okay.
And you can get instructions for that online too.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for your call.
Okay.
Right, take care. Let's see. What time is it? Do we have time for? We have time for another call.
Let's brave it.
Pure Heart and Aptos.
Yeah. Hi, team. I'm having problems with my Mozilla browser or anything based on Mozilla, like Epiphany, etc.
So you're running on Linux.
I'm using a Mandrake 10.1 distribution, and I thought I would help speed up my Google searches by removing a bunch of the advertisers. So I added a bunch of their hosts to my host deny file. And suddenly it started locking up. That's about two-thirds of the way through a search, it just lock up. So I uncommented all my host type that I put in there. Eventually ended up removing Mozilla and reinstalling it. But it still locks up two-thirds of the way through a search, initial search, for all users. So there's got to be something else.
What you did, reinstalling the browser shouldn't have been necessary.
I'm getting desperate.
Especially with host deny. Host deny is just, it's just a simple text file that's going to, when it's doing the lookup, it's just going to block that. But,
I removed all those things with host deny, so it's clear again. But I'm still, and I cleared all my cookies, et cetera. And all users are suffering from this, bro. I don't know what I did. But any suggestions, what else to try before I...
When you say all users, are you administering a network, or do you mean all users that you have configured on your machine?
It's configured on my machine.
Okay.
It's root, and then all my family, et cetera, everybody. Other routers like Conqueror and Opera work fine, but anything that's Mozilla-based choke. So there's, I'm wondering what, where to look.
That's interesting. Other browsers are fine. It's so it's specifically the Mozilla, and you've reinstalled Mozilla.
Yes, and its dependencies. Hmm. But I was fussing around. I was using Mozilla at the time. I was playing around with the hosting iFile, so I figured, you know, maybe there's a cookie set somewhere, but something with a bit of text I need to change.
Oh, this is unusual. You've got us looking with furrowed brows.
Is it specifically Google searches, or is any
Google
web page?
Google search. It doesn't affect video, pictures, and other things. This time, dial-up, by the way, are fine. But the initial web search, it'll show up on the initial screen. I type in a term, hit search. It'll load. There's a little status bar at the bottom, of course, it's just, you know, arbitrary. That'll go about two-thirds of the way, and things will show up on the screen. Then it'll lock, totally lock. I have to actually kill the application because it stopped responding.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
I have to go to a different screen.
I think it may be coincidental to your host and iFile.
Yeah, I think it's
something else going on with
your
system. Fortunately, I don't know that we have time to be able to diagnose it.
Yeah, if this were me, I'd be scratching my head and spending
empty
time.
Now, but,
yeah. Does it write log files, or can you turn up HiDebug on Mozilla?
So they look at the logs. I can't see anything that's sort of I can interpret. I'm just a neophyte, but. I do look through the logs, and I don't see anything that really gives me a clue. You know, I tail them, and I have a log open in a different window, start at the tail dash, which just keeps going while it's doing.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't think of anything that would be usable. The only thing I can suggest at this point is going up to the Mozilla site and downloading the newest version directly from them as a tarball, and just installing it from there and trying it out. There may be something wrong with the package. Thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. And KUSP invites you to join us for an evening of wine from Santa Cruz Mountain Vineyard and hors d'oeuvres from Main Street Garden Cafe at Upgrade 2011, our February 10th fundraiser at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History, to bring our outdated equipment into the 21st century. This is your chance to meet Dr. Don and us, the geeks from GeekSpeak, and bid on a range of wines and weekends away in our silent auction. Information and tickets for Upgrade 2011 are available at KUSP.org. And Al, do you have the crazy USB?
Yeah. There's this device I ran across. And, you know, it's funny. It was the title of the actual webpage is Stupid USB Gadget. So I know this is going to be, you know, what it is it's a plane that it's a little toy plane. It's got four USB ports on where the engines would be on the wings. But then it's got a propeller in the front. You know, so it's got a propeller in the front. So you plug it in and the propeller spins. And if you look at it, it's like I have to put my cable through where the propeller spins to get it into the plug. So when the propeller spins, it would bang into the cable of the USB. And it's just ridiculous. God. And the thing is, and when you use it, it's actually very loud. I don't know if you can hear that.
That's
not
really
something I'd want to hear while I was using my computer.
Definitely not something you want to give to a toddler.
Yes. It's a reel, and it's linked on geekspeak.org after the show.
All right,
is it powered USB?
That's a good question.
All right, thank you for that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz.